Hey, this is WTOP's Jason Fraley, and we are being joined by, just say your name and your title.
Steve Leggett, Program Coordinator, National Film Preservation Board.
And we are talking because your National Film Preservation Board has helped select the Library of Congress's National Film Registry. I know you pick 25 new selections every year. I want to get into some of them because they are totally, you know, beloved classic fan favorites across a bunch of genres. Some really fun picks this year. But before we get to the actual individual movies, overview it for me. You know, like how do you go about selecting these? Is it a giant, you know, boardroom? Are there fan submissions? You know, what's the process?
It's kind of a three-step process. We accept public nominations each year. And this year, the public nominated about 6,800 different titles.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, there were a lot. And then we send those on. There's a 44-member National Film Preservation Board, which is an advisory body to the Librarian of Congress, Dr. Hayden. So we send the nominations onto the board. And then they have a couple of study groups and other processes. They vote a couple of times on their favorites. And then the board's final voting results and the public nominations are sent to Dr. Hayden, and she makes the final selections.
Gotcha. And so how would you describe like the criteria? I know it always says, you know, quote, culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant, but well, I can't use the soundbite if I have it in my voice. So why don't we have you say that or, you know, and whatever else you want to say about how, you know, what constitutes a movie worthy of making the list?
I think we just try to pick a film that it has significance and ongoing significance, be it for, you know, its aesthetics or historical importance or a director or a personality, because the congressional language, as you said, is very broad. It can include almost anything. So we just look for stuff, you know, try to have a diverse group of films that also remain significant.
Awesome. Well, let's go into a few of them. I'll throw out one of the titles and then we can, you know, break them down, you know, individually. And we won't go through all of them, but I'll just handpick a couple.
Sure.
So I know this year's list includes a movie that's near and dear to my heart because it was probably the first or second movie I ever saw in the theater was The Little Mermaid, Disney's animated musical. Why we go with this one?
I think it just showed this was after Disney had a kind of a lapse in terms of popularity in some of their titles. So it's kind of a rebirth. And it's just such a great, you know, animation title for the public. And also they started introducing Broadway type of songs into the musical. So it really kind of launched a new genre right there.
Go ahead.
It's had such an abiding influence, you know, to this day.
Oh yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that you know, in the 80s, it's hard to believe, but in the 80s, you know, what we're like, you know, Walt died in like 67. I think Jungle Book was the last, but then in the 80s, they were pretty much the animation department was almost going to close down. They were hurting. And it was this idea that the Little Mermaid to do, you know, like a Broadway musical in Part of Your World and Under the Sea and Kiss the Girl, et cetera, et cetera, that talk about how it sort of launched the Disney Renaissance with Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Lion King, you know, talk about how it launched a new era of musicals.
I just think it did. It gave brought in a broader audience by bringing in kind of the Broadway concepts and people doing sing-alongs. And so it's kind of a new step for Disney, but it's really been copied. And again, it was just with Jeffrey Katzenberg had become, you know, one of the new leaders at Disney. And this was one of his ideas along with others. But it really did just kind of broaden the audience. You know, musicals after the 1950s or so had become kind of stale in Hollywood. And so this was, you know, Disney's kind of attempt to bring it back into Hollywood.
Absolutely. And I think it did. Awesome. All right. Well, in addition to The Little Mermaid, we also have something superhero fans are going to love. Marvel's Iron Man 2008, Jon Favreau directed, Tony Stark, played by Robert Downey Jr. Talk about why you went with this, because sort of kicking off the whole MCU, right?
Right. So we were just trying to recognize the beginning of the MCU and the impact that it's had. It's just obviously had a huge impact. We had, Pixar had a big impact in the 90s and the 2000s, and Marvel has had a big impact as a new company, you know, starting with this one, the first feature, and continuing. It's just, especially with certain generations of Americans, they really love the Marvel product and the films. And it's a different kind of filmmaking. I know it's been controversial to a degree, but it's just, you know, it really brings in new audiences. And we wanted to recognize Marvel's contribution to American cinema.
Absolutely. It's sort of the episodic will, you know, have a post-credit teaser. It's almost like the episodic TV shows we watch, but on the big screen in a way. It sort of transformed everything, the whole model. Right. So. And talk about why Robert Downey Jr. was so perfect as Tony Stark. I mean, he's such a snarky smartass, but we love him for it anyway. We love him 3,000 for it. But yeah, I mean, is there a better person cast with actor character, you know, marriage between actor and character than that? I can't think of one.
I don't think so. He can play such a complex range of emotions and different styles that I think he was the perfect fit for it. It gives it kind of a gravitas also to the movie that I think they needed to really kind of launch, you know, the cycle to give it credence, for, you know, with the public and critics. But he's just, you know, he can really play almost anything from Chaplin to, you know, Iron Man. So,
absolutely. All right, moving right along. One of my favorite horror movies ever made. It was a Stephen King novel, but then Brian De Palma, of course, adapted it in 1976. Carrie, why'd we? It's overdue, in my opinion. Why'd we go with Carrie?
Yes, it probably could have been picked 10 or 15 years ago. We picked it for a couple of reasons. I think, you know, as you said, it's a key, you know, kind of touchstone film in the horror genre. And we also didn't have any Brian De Palma films. And this was one where he really made his mark, at least with the public consciousness. He had done a lot of good independent stuff before then, but we wanted to recognize Brian De Palma. And again, it's just, you know, every kind of the teen horror movie kind of thing. It was one of the very first of that. So.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad that you mentioned the teen element. And Sissy Spacek was so good. With, you know, and the horrific ending with the blood dropped on her at the prom and the fire and the flames and all that. But I'm glad you got De Palma in here because talk if you can talk about some of his filmmaking techniques. Like I know that the end of the prom, right? Don't they do it? He does like a big figure eight like tracking shot to reveal the blood on the stage in the beginning. There's that slow-mo in like the steamy shower when she has her first period. Like I mean, talk about he's a visionary director in this thing.
He's a visionary director. He's obviously, you could see that he's a student of film. You know, Hitchcock was one of his primary influences. So he uses a lot of Hitch's techniques and he just brings it all, you know, the whole shebang of techniques to this movie. So
great point with the Hitchcock, because every time she uses her telekinesis, it sounds like the Psycho slashing them. It's like, wait, wait, and things move across the classroom or whatever. Awesome. Well, something completely different. Maybe time for one or two more. Arguably my favorite romantic comedy ever. 1989, When Harry Met Sally. Perfect pick for the National Film Registry, written by Nora Ephron, directed by Rob Reiner. We had to go with this one.
Right. It was probably a little bit overdue as well, but we'd had some Rob Reiner films before, and he was in such a great streak right here of having, you know, hit after hit. And but this one is just a great romantic comedy, you know, harkening back a little bit to the 30s and 40s, but, you know, with a new 80s kind of refresh. But the script, as you say, is just magnificent. There's a lot, they did a lot of ad-libbing, but it just really works with the chemistry between Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan and some of the sidekicks as well. And so it's really one of the better romantic comedies, I think, of all time.
And of course, Rob Reiner's mom delivering the famous line, I'll have what she's having. Right. Awesome. And thank you for mentioning Rob Reiner's run there. Like, I don't know if a director's had a better run from what, Spinal Tap. And then what did he do right after that? Stand By Me, Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, A Few Good Men, American President. Like, come on. Come on.
Yeah, you can't really beat that. I mean, Preston Sturges had a great run back in the 40s, but I mean, this one easily, I think, meets that at least. So.
That's a good point because Sullivan's Travels and The Lady Eve and Palm Beach Story and Miracle Morgan's Creek. Oh, right, yeah, you're right. That might be the best comp there to Mr. Reiner's, especially sort of in the comedy vein. Awesome. Well, you and I could riff on this all day. Are there any other ones? How about, well, we got Hairspray, we got Cyrano de Bergerac, Pariah. How about Titicut Follies?
Yeah, this is a very interesting one because it was Frederick Wiseman's first documentary that he directed. And, you know, he went into the institution and he had permission. But, you know, the end product was not something that the institution or the state of Massachusetts liked because it really showed, you know, the guards treating the inmates poorly and just what a miserable existence the inmates had. So it was, you know, and the state of Massachusetts went to court to get it pulled from release. And it stayed, you know, basically out of public sight for a long time. You had to be like a lawyer or a medical professional to see it. And then eventually in the early 90s, the Massachusetts Supreme Court, you know, allowed it to become, you could be screened again with a disclaimer. But it's just, it's such a fundamentally, you know, important documentary for the light it's shown on how mental hospitals were, you know, back in that era, not just in Massachusetts, of course, but, you know, all across the country, there were really some egregious practices going on. And they had not been modern techniques introduced into how to treat people like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we got to remember, this was like 8 years before Cuckoo's Nest, sort of, you know, mainstream in a mainstream movie. But like, I remember watching Titicut Follies in film school, and like, it just blew my mind, like the access and the cameras, like recording this really damning footage of how the patients are being treated there.
He's done probably almost 50 movies, you know, about American institutions, you know, all of all types. And he's got a very interesting techniques. He goes in and films for about 4 weeks, you know, does a ton of footage and then reassembles it. And, you know, but he does present a very good portrait of the institution. Now, if the institution is in good shape, that's great. But if it's in bad shape, he's going to find it.
How about Hairspray, since there's a bit of a local connection, the Baltimore connection with John Waters? Talk about how originally, you know, we all think of it as this Broadway musical, and then of course the new musical remake with Travolta and everything, but talk about how originally it was a dance movie. It wasn't necessarily a musical in the beginning.
Right. I mean, he'd had some films before that weren't this mainstream, so this was more mainstream, but it was, you know, kind of like, and also it brought in the theme of integration, trying to, you know, a dance contest and, you know, trying to integrate that. But it's just such a fun movie. You know, it shows Baltimore back in the early 60s, and it's just got all the, you know, the big woman with the big hair and stuff like that. So it's just such a fun film, and you can see why it's been adapted, you know, for Broadway and TV and everything else, because they just really, they're such winning characters and such a fun movie. And, you know, it's more accessible than a lot of Waters films, but it's still got that Waters touch to it. So.
Absolutely. And then I guess let's time for one more, maybe. I know the most recent one of this year's crop is Pariah, right? 2011.
Yes.
Dee Reese, where she made Mud. I thought Mudbound was so good in like 2017. But talk about why Pariah is a good one to rep the most recent this year.
Well, again, we have been trying to, you know, recognize films directed by women and persons of color, because traditionally Hollywood really did not give them much of a chance, you know, until the last couple of decades or so. And Dee Reese has been a very important new figure. And also as a lesbian, we thought that would be, you know, she's one of the key women lesbian filmmakers, you know, the last 20 years. There haven't been a lot. We had Cheryl Dunier last year. But it's a very interesting story. She says that she had moved to Brooklyn and she met some teens who were coming out, and they just kind of put it into her mind, because she was in the process of coming out then, of how difficult that would be to do as a teen. And she just thought it would be a great story, and it was. And it just really comes across on the screen with great acting. And we really wanted to recognize Dee Reese, because we think she's a major new talent.
Oh, absolutely. Here to stay. Hopefully many more movies to come from Dee Reese. Just masterful stuff. Well, thank you so much. We can link to the full list and everything on our website. But I guess before we run, I just wanted to, if you could tease it, aren't you doing a cool tie-in with Turner Classic Movies this year? They're going to show some of them?
They are going to show four or five of them on December 27th, the evening of December 27th.
And the Librarian of Congress, Dr. Carla Hayden, is going to be sitting down and doing some, like, introducing some of them, like in those old, like, Robert Osborne, rest in peace. There's like sort of intro segment, or Ben Mankiewicz, I guess nowadays you've done. But who's she going to talk to?
She's going to be talking with Jacqueline Stewart, who's the chair of the film board, but also who's president and director of the Academy Museum in Los Angeles. And Jacqueline is also a TCM host. She does Saturday nights, usually, a lot of times with silent movies. And she's terrific, academic and you know, knows her films. And she'll be interviewing and talking with Dr. Hayden.
That is a really cool cross promotion, and I hope that that becomes like an annual thing. You know what I mean? We're going to pick a handful of the movies from this year's 25, and you can watch them on TCM if you hadn't seen them in a while.
Yeah, we've done it probably about four times now, I think, in the last 5 years. So hopefully we can make it an annual tradition. So.
Oh, cool. Yeah, keep it going. I think that's a genius way to sort of to keep those movies alive. Great. Well, I really appreciate you joining us. This was a lot of fun.
Oh, many thanks. And again, apologies for being late. And if you need any more information, I'm here to help you with.
He was worth the wait, Steve.
Oh, appreciate that.
So. All right. We'll talk to you later.
Hey, thanks, Jason. Enjoy your stuff. So thanks.
Yep. Oh, thank you so much. Thanks.